Blog Talk Radio.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Listeners, you've just tuned in to the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show with Rosita and Robert. It's September 26th. I don't even know what day it is. It's September 22nd, and it's 6 p.m. Pacific. Wow, that's why I need a co-host. Speaking of which, here is my co-host and brother in martial arts, Sifu Robert Deal. Sifu Bob, see, that's why I need a co-host. I don't even know what today is.
You do. You know how many times I straighten you out? I'm telling you. Boy, you know, I'm in Southern California. We could not have asked for a more beautiful first day of fall.
I hate you.
It's in the 70s. The sky is absolutely perfect.
I hate you. We've had a monsoon here. I mean, it was like coming down in sheets, and I had to drive home in it from class. I was like, are you frigging serious? I was like, I need to get home. I got a show to do. What's going on? Why is everyone going so slow? Oh, it's raining. So, yeah, Seattle. Go figure.
Yeah.
Well, for our listeners out there, we have a wonderful show ahead of us and a wonderful guest. So if you'd like to call in and speak live with us, our phone number here is 347-677-0699. Call it at any time. But I'm guessing you should probably call in within the next 45 minutes to an hour. We also have a chat board on the Blog Talk Radio Marquee. So if you're just listening on your computer, just go to the marquee, scroll down a little bit, and you'll find our chat board. You can type your questions there. So with that said, let's get the show rolling, Sifu Bob. So you have the honors of introducing our special guest.
Absolutely. We didn't have to do rock, paper, scissors or anything. She just gave it to me today.
Yeah.
I was really honored that he accepted my offer to be on the show. I've known the last time I think I saw our guest was at House of Champions in one of their fight nights. This was like 2003, 2005, something like that. Please help me welcome the show. And it really is a true honor. Help me welcome Richard Norton to the show. Thank you for joining us, Richard.
So, my pleasure. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Rosita. Good to be with you.
Yes, thank you for taking the time out of your busy day. Now, what I usually like to start off with is to give the listeners a little bit of a background on our guest. And normally I usually say a short bio before we introduce anyone, but, you know, I think it would be really cool if you would just tell our listeners about your martial arts background. We'll get it straight from the source. So could you tell us a little bit about your martial arts experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you as much an abbreviated version as I can. I started judo when I was 11 years of age, and Japanese karate, goju-ryu, when I was around about 14 and a half. Mm-hmm. I trained with a gentleman named Tino Sabarano, who basically introduced you into Australia, who was Hawaiian-Filipino, Hanchi Tino. And then 5-6 years later, started a whole line of schools, our own style, with a friend of mine called Bob Jones. So Bob started. Bob, you know, was older than I and wanted to basically do an Australian version, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that was called Zendo Kai. And was involved in Zendo Kai with Bob. We started that in 1970 here in Australia. One state we had over 500 schools throughout the country. And in the late 70s, I met Chuck Norris here in Australia. We brought him out to Australia to do some demonstrations, and I was demonstrating on the same card. Got on extremely well with Mr. Norris. And at the time, I was also doing personal bodyguard work with rock and roll bands like Rolling Stones and Joe Cocker and David Bowie and Fleetwood Mac, etc. So I ended up in the United States in 1979 working full-time for Linda Ronstadt. And from there, I started training with Chuck at his house every morning when he was living out in Rolling Hills Estates in Los Angeles. From there, I was introduced by Chuck to Sensei Benny the Jet Urquidez, and on it goes. You know, I started training then in kickboxing and with Pete Sugarfoot Cunningham, also became one of my coaches in kickboxing. That went on for many years. I trained with Fumio Demura, Tadashi Yamashita, and Bill Wallace, and all the people around at that time. George Chung, Cynthia Rothrock became a very close friend. And I think it was in 1986 I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I started off with Hickson Gracie and went on there. Now that's 26 years later or whatever it is, I'm still involved in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So that's, in a nutshell, it's kind of been what we now know as mixed martial arts. Started way back kind of mixing the arts up. Zendo Kai, the style I had, was always about MMA, meaning not the sport version as in UFC, but the idea of mixing boxing and grappling and wrestling and whatever else worked in the combat sense, we sort of tried to incorporate into the Zendo Kai style.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's quite a lot of legends there also that you've studied with. That's exciting.
Yeah, no, it is. It's been an incredible journey, and you know, I've been very blessed to be able to train with some of the best in the world, from traditional martial arts to kickboxers to weapons experts, and now of course in the art of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So it's been fantastic, and of course I still look back on my beginnings as a teenager in Goju and feel so thankful that Hanchitino Soberano started me on my journey, because I often say to people, when you start your training, you don't really know whether your instructor's good or bad because you don't know anything. Mm-hmm. And you either waste a lot of time and money or both to find out that maybe you didn't have the best instruction. Well, I know in hindsight with everything I know now that I couldn't have had a better foundation with my training. So I'm forever indebted to Hanchitino for that guidance and everything. And, for me, it's just an ever-ending search. You know, I'm a believer that we're always students, and we should always acknowledge that we're students of the art. You know, once you sort of assume mastery of anything, then I think your ego and your arrogance can take over and you start to punch around and stop learning. And mm-hmm. It's about daring to participate, getting into new areas, being uncomfortable, you know, exposing yourself to anything new that's out there and seeing if it can enhance the skills that you've already attained.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Now, what got you interested in wanting to pursue martial arts as a teenager? Because, like, for me, it was the Kung Fu TV series. but I know it differs from person to person. So what got you interested?
You know what? It's, we didn't even have that. When I was 11, I'm talking 11 years old, I was 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And, the only show that we have that I still so fondly remember was, the Samurai, the black and white
mm-hmm.
show, which just intrigued the life out of me. You know, I just loved that show. And there was a friend who was learning. A guy came and moved into a house opposite to where I lived in Croydon, which is a suburb of Melbourne in Australia. And he was disappearing a couple of nights a week. And I asked him where he's going, and he said he was going to a judo class.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remembered being just so excited at the idea of that, because I've said this before, that literally the only exposure I had then was the ads on the back of comic books advertising judo. Karate was almost unknown really here, or at least as far as what we were able to sort of go and actually, get involved in. So I started judo, but I was very skinny, very little as an 11-year-old, and I loved it, but was kind of like cannon fodder for the older teenage brown belts and up. And another school friend had been learning karate out of Masayama's book at the time, and he was sort of showing me bits of things in his garage. You know, he had a punching bag and a kick bag put up and try to sort of break boards and do things like this. And this is purely out of a book. But again, it was just like a mystical lure to the whole thing. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not, we know now today that martial arts is a lot of hard work and application and everything else. But back then, it just almost had a magical sort of connotation to it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, and Johnny's name was, he suddenly told us there was a karate school opening up about 3 miles from where I lived. And we all went and had a look, and that was a demonstration of Goju Karate by Hanchitino. And he'd only been in the country 6 months, and, you know, it was just very basic H pattern forms, a little bit of what's called Jukumite, you know, kind of controlled mm-hmm. sparring. But I just saw that, and I just knew that's just what I wanted to do with my life. And I saw karate as more of a standoff sport involving more agility and speed as opposed to judo, which, regardless of what anyone likes to sort of think, at that age and that stage, it was definitely something that involved size and strength, at least from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved the idea of karate, and I started up with Hanchi, and that's what started me off on the journey. But it wasn't through, you know, a lot of kids say, oh, you know, we're beaten up by the local neighborhood gang and I had to learn how to fight. It was never about that for me. I was always very physical, you know, as normal with a kid running around in the bush, as we call it here, and having little boxing matches and wrestling. But it wasn't from the point of view of getting bullied by kids in the neighborhood school. I honestly look back now and I just believe that it was what I was meant to do with my life. And I think I picked up on that energy and that whole attraction, which is why, you know, 50-something years later, I'm still very, very heavily involved in the arts and couldn't be happier, you know, with having chosen that as a prime focus of my life.
Awesome. Very awesome.
Wow. That is so cool. Now, Richard, I don't know that much about where you're from, about Australia, because I'm from L.A. Now, you've lived in L.A. What is it like in Australia growing up as a child? Is there bullying? Is there a high crime rate? What's it like over there?
Yes, there's all of that. You know, it's not a lot different. You know, as you rightfully pointed out, I lived in L.A. for 30-plus years. I moved there in 1979. Look, growing up, yes, it's really, you know, microcosm. It's the same thing you go through in America. I mean, we, you know, Australia, like America, is a very multicultural and very multinational country. You know, there's a lot of, you know, it was built on immigrants, you know, from all parts of the world and everything. So it's not like there was only Aussies here.
Mm-hmm.
So you had issues involving race, you know, in this country, like anywhere else that, in, you know, has a multi sort of national population. But the only thing we didn't have a lot of course, growing up, which I know is a huge thing in America, which I won't even get into, but it's the prevalence of firearms. You know, back when I grew up, it was more about fist fights, and, you know, it's changed a lot now. There's more and more guns on the street as far as the baddies are concerned. They still get them, but still there's very, very strict gun laws here. It's not as easy to get hold of a gun, and if you do use one, you know, it's a lot of strife for you. So I would say that we don't have that kind of hanging over our heads as much as in places, certainly in different states in America. You know, it's more so than others. But as far as bullying, you know, I started working on the doors when I was a teenager as a bouncer, as we call it here, doorman, and they were discos back then. Shows you how old I am. They're not clubs, they were discotheques. And, you know, we had, you know, certainly, you know, back then the saying was, if you wanted to go, as an Aussie, if you wanted to go out and have a good time, you had a few drinks and got into a fight. And if you happened to pick up a young lady, that was good, but it wasn't necessary to having a good night, you know. Aussies were very, very predetermined to get into some sort of physical scuff. I mean, it's a, you know, even our sporting sort of prowess proves that. We're very competitive, very physical. And that was the nature as far as street combat went as well. But, you know, it's changed a lot. When I was on the doors, there was still a little bit of honor as far as if six guys turned up, you could, say, basically have what we call the one out. You know, you could just sort of duke it out with one guy and the rest would stay out of it. And mm-hmm. whoever won, that was the end of it. Nowadays, it doesn't happen that way. It's kind of 6-on-1, 8-on-1, and everybody's carrying blades, you know, they got some sort of knives, machetes or whatever. Not everybody, but you know what I mean, there's a mm-hmm. there's a huge sort of increase in that kind of crime. And and violence. And of course, to a certain extent, there's still a lot of gun violence. Again, you won't get the, you know, AK-47s or anything like that on the streets, but there are a certain amount of handguns. You know, whereas in LA, as you know, you learn, as far as road rage or anything, you've got to be very careful if you get involved in altercations, because the possibility of somebody having a gun tucked under their seat is a very high percentage.
Right.
So it changes the nature of what we do, meaning unarmed combat, because suddenly it's a whole different arena. But, you know, if anyone from America was to go to Sydney, you would find it very much like Los Angeles, you know, with beaches, the weather, the climate and everything else. And the whole feel of the city is very much like LA. For me, where I live in Melbourne, my feeling is it reminds me very much of San Francisco. Sort of Victorian architecture, a little more art, you know, inspired. And but not a lot of differences, you know. And I'm talking LA, of course. I've been over all the different states in the US because I did so much touring as a personal bodyguard for the rock and roll band. So I've got to see all of your country. And I know if you're in the South, it's very different from being, say, in New York City or Oklahoma or Phoenix or places like that. So, you know, but we're the same, you know, in the city, everybody, Australia, all the capital cities are pretty much on the coast. And, you know, you go inland, it's very barren, it's quite arid. So, it's like America. You could be in the city and you could drive, you know, 100 miles and be out in the wilderness, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Similar.
Oh, very cool. Now, you talked a little bit about your bodyguarding experience. Tell us more about your bodyguarding experience. You mentioned some of the rock and roll bands that you were with. How long were you a bodyguard? Are there any stories that you can actually share with us on the air?
Well, I was a bodyguard for around 25 years. And again, I started in 1973 with the Rolling Stones, and that came about through we had a concert or a pop concert called Sunbury, which was our copy of your Woodstock festival, and you know, it was a huge open door music festival. And one of the entrepreneurs involved in that was a guy called Paul Dainty, and Paul was bringing the Rolling Stones out because we'd work with him at different times, security events. He rang Bob Jones and myself and asked if we'd be interested in looking after the Rolling Stones, and of course we said yes. And it really just snowballed from there. You know, as I said, I ended up working with Stevie Nicks, and when she went solo, of course, Fleetwood Mac for quite a number of years, David Bowie for 6 years, James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt for like 14 years, Joe Cocker back in the day. So it was, you know, it covered quite a few of the top names of the day. The Rolling Stones, of course, was just a phenomenal intro into the world of bodyguarding, because, you know, you're into just working with, you know, the top rock and roll band in the world. And I'd be at 4 o'clock in the morning. I remember Mick Jagger loved learning bits of karate, so I'd be teaching him reverse punches and everything at 4 a.m. And the reason for that is you do a concert and you get home and everybody's all adrenalized and amped up, so you just sort of stay up. And that, you know, they're exciting times, because I, you know, you got to hang with these guys on a one-on-one sort of basis, and it just gives you a real insight into the people behind the band and behind, you know, the media, that sort of the way they depict the band.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened a lot for me, you know, like ABBA. I worked with ABBA in the late 70s, and they were as big as the Beatles here in Australia. They were just absolutely huge and just the loveliest people. You know, I used to, you know, because part of what I did as a bodyguard and what was attractive to a lot of the bands was the fact that I was so addicted to staying in shape myself, I'd sort of basically get the band up every morning and give them a workout of stretches and conditioning exercises. And the girls in the band, Anna and Frida, would work out just about every day we were. And that was exciting. They were so lovely. Never wore makeup off stage. Very unaffected. So down to earth, you know, at the same time as being superstars. James Taylor, Linda Ronstadt, you just nicer people. You know, same thing. I would work them out every day. I remember with James, I ended up in Martha's Vineyard, you know, off the coast there of Massachusetts, and mm-hmm. was working him through bow forms, you know, with the staff and exercises, because I'm not giving away secrets here, because I would never do that. I was in such a confidence. The nice end result of working with James was that he completely gave up everything, drinking, smoking, any sort of drugs. And I feel really good about that. A couple of years ago, James was out here with Carole King doing some concerts, and he actually had his tour manager find me, and he invited my wife and I, Judy, up to Sydney, and flew us up to Sydney, and we hung out with James. He was doing some concerts at some vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
Got to meet Carole King. It was nice, because even then James sort of said to Carole King, he said, Richard changed my life, you know, with the exercise and what he introduced us to. And I thought that was really lovely, you know, to know you have a bit of an influence on somebody's life, because he's just again, talk about the nicest person you ever meet. And the same with Linda. Linda Ronstadt was the same. They were just lovely people, and I feel blessed to be able to sort of get into that inner.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. So I was working Linda, and John saw that. And from then on, I'm the only one he wanted, you know. And why I say that is it's basically because Linda had me, and they were good friends and everything.
Uh-oh. What happened?
What happened?
I don't know. I have no idea. Let me figure that out. Sorry about that, folks. I guess, let me see here. Dun-dun-dun. We lost Richard. Let me try this again. Let me get him back. Whoops. All of a sudden, he just dropped. I don't know what happened. So let me see here. Dun-dun-dun. There he is. Okay. Nope. Try that again. He's probably wondering what's going on too. Oh, we don't want Dennis Mace on here, so we'll add him on again. Yeah, that was weird.
No, we dropped out.
Yeah, that was weird. I don't know what happened.
Well, Richard, you know what? I have a friend of yours on the line. Can you take a call?
Yes, of course I can.
All right, let's click that on. Area code 847. Area code 847. Go ahead. You're on Dynamic Dojo.
Hey, what's up, Sensei? What's cracking, man? You know this
is it? No.
This is Greg Wooldridge.
Mate, how are you?
I am good. I'm good. You know, I heard you're going to be on the show tonight, and just had to call in to hopefully share with everybody listening that what a treat it is for them to have a chance to listen to you. You know, you're the cream of the crop, Sensei. And you're one of the people that helped shape the martial arts in more ways than most people know. And the fact that you're on the show just blows me away, and I'm very proud of you. I'm just proud to be part of your family, Sensei.
Greg, thank you, mate. I very much appreciate that. I was in your old stomping ground about a month ago. Did a seminar there with Sensei Mark and the lads.
Oh, did you really? Did you really? Okay.
House of Champions. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting? I told Bob that I haven't had a chance to tell Restita. You know, I go back about 24 years with Master Norton. And when I was coming up as a bodyguard, about 25 years old, going through some issues. I was with Quincy Jones at the time, and I was going through some political things I couldn't quite navigate. And who did I meet? At the gym, and we started talking. He took me in, and we've been he's been a sensei of mine and a guide ever since. And as a matter of fact, guidance that Master Norton gave me not only moved me through the environment properly, but I was fortunate to get some very, very big people as a result of putting a good strategy together and then having a chance to do some DVDs with Sensei, and we did the Magnificent Seven, and you know, and we had a chance to talk about the psychology of issues, and not just from a Kanate side, but from a protector side and a psychology side. And, you know, and then I was fortunate enough to get my purple belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu with Pastor Norton and Lou Salcido and Big John McCarthy. And it's just been a fabulous time I've had to spend with Master Norton. And I'm just humbled, Sensei, to be able to call you Sensei and to have earned that. And I love you dearly. I love you dearly.
Thank you, Mike. They're very kind words. Thank you. And, you know, for those out there, you're also talking, listening to somebody who's the real deal. And Greg knows what I mean by that. There's a lot of people out there that theorize on and teach what they believe will work and has some sort of combat aspect to it. But there's others that have actually sort of walked the talk. And you're one of them, my friend. And, you know, I loved what when we did that Magnificent Seven. I mean, it all becomes very evident when you see somebody display their skills. So, you know, hats off to you. There's a good reason why you did get such big names and get to look after some of the best, you know, because you, as we know, you don't have what it takes. You get found out very quickly in this industry.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Amen. That's true. Mm-hmm.
Greg, will you be able to stay online with us?
No, you know what? I have to go handle something right now. I wish I had was able to plan this. I just had to call in just to pay my respects to Master Norton, who I truly believe is one of the shakers and makers of the martial arts that we now have the benefit to be a part of. And to say that he touched my life is an understatement. He's guided that. He's guided me in so many ways, and he does it so subtly. He does it with a gentle touch and a kind word. And let me tell you, that is a rare, rare quality to have such mastery. You know, I just love you, Sensei. You know, I'm your biggest fan, and I'm always going to be your biggest fan.
That's great, mate. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Hey, guys, have a great night. Love to everybody. And, Sensei, I'd like to give you a call in the next week or two just to catch up if you're okay with that.
Absolutely. Anytime, my friend.
Outstanding. Have a great night. Have a great show, everybody. Man, mad respects to you, Master, and I love you dearly. Have a great night.
Oh, thank you, mate. Bye.
Thanks
Bye.
For calling, Soke. Bye-bye now.
Well, and Rusty, I did want to point out, you know, Greg, one of my dearest friends, and, you know, I met Richard a couple times. These two guys really looked down their nose at me only because they're, like, over 6 feet and I'm only 5 feet.
It wasn't only that, Bob. No, I'm kidding.
oh man, there went that knife.
Come on. That's the odd.
How many people in the world can say I was up at 4 a.m. teaching the Rolling Stones how to focus punch?
Right.
Well, and while I was finishing off, I mean, this is the point of, you know, this whole journey that I've had. It's all been a result of just wanting to be the best martial artist I can be, but to look back and to be on the set with Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, and people Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, just fantastic. And I was going to just finish off my little thing now about people like James, because remember I said that you get to sort of see the other side of that world. And, you know, James and I flew up in a private jet to Martha's Vineyard for John Belushi's funeral, because obviously they were very good friends as well as I was. And that was quite a moving experience. It was an open coffin funeral. And, I remember going there and the church was full of people from Saturday Night Live, cast members and various musicians and everything else. And to go in there and sort of see this 32-year-old, you know, lying in a coffin was you get a real reality check, you know. And I remember there was an Albanian Orthodox priest who was giving a sermon, and it was at one stage he was talking about, you know, somebody like John not having a chance to, you know, really see or at least talents come to fruition. And there was one time he just stopped talking and he seemed like he looked at everybody in that church and just suddenly boomed out, "Wise up," obviously referring to drug use. And, boy, you could have heard a pin drop. You know, there's moments in my life I remember like that that you just never forget. And to sort of be a part of history in the worst way as well as in the best ways is quite something. But there you go. But there's a lot of survivors out there. There were rough and tough times on the road as far as what was available to artists and what was accepted or thought to be the accepted thing, you know, that went with being a rock and roller. And again, I'm so glad that so many people did get through it and cleaned up their acts and are still living incredibly healthy and full lives, you know, regardless. Mm-hmm. So it's nice. It's been a great journey. As far as stories on the road, you know, there are lots. I don't like to sort of talk about any violence and everything because I don't know. I don't like to talk in a way that it's almost you're almost glorifying in a sense. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. Needless to say, my job as a bodyguard was the last line of defense. You know, when you had concerts, you would have local security. I would always be in charge and be able to tell them where to be, when the crowd should be able to approach the stage and blah, 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 blah. And that would always vary depending on the artist. And, the worst times were when you went out to a local bar or party or club, and then I was always one out. That gets a little hairy because you go to some little town in outback USA and it's just you and a rock star, and you've got to be on your toes as far as that part of the job goes. But I always felt pretty confident in my abilities and what I did, you know, and then again got through it all without being stabbed or knifed or shot. So, and I say that almost tongue in cheek, but I had two friends that were shot and killed doing this sort of work in the US. So it was always on the cards. And in fact, that's one of the reasons I stopped doing it when I started to think about my mortality and the fact that, gee, I've been pretty lucky. And I knew that once I started thinking that way, it was a good time to give it up. Mm-hmm. Because as cliche as it sounds, before that, I really was prepared to be the one that stepped in the way of a bullet, should it be coming. And that was what your job required because, you know, most of the time you're having a wonderful time with the band, treated like a member of the band and all of that. Your job was really that one in a million time that, you know, the shit was going to hit the fan, as they say. Mm-hmm. And that's the time you had to be there and you had to be prepared that without any sort of second thoughts. And I just believe that when you did start second guessing that aspect, then it was a good time to stop. And that's what I did.
Exactly. Now, earlier you said that that if you don't have what it takes in that industry, then people find out really quick or you get punched, and which is true. You know, it's like years ago, someone asked me if I wanted to get into executive protection, and I was like, no, because right, you know, just, you know, kind of being like the escort for dignitaries and being the female escort for dignitaries, you know, like their date type of thing when they went to dinners. And I was like, I don't know. And it wasn't so much that I wasn't confident. It was that I had already pondered my mortality in a way. But the same thing kind of holds true for the film industry. If you don't have what it takes, then you don't get big into the film industry, which kind of leads me into this next question. What got you interested in getting into the film industry? Was it a natural course of events because you were bodyguards for actors and music celebrities?
No. I had no aspirations to get into the movie business. And as I'd mentioned earlier, when I met Chuck Norris in 1978, we became immediate friends. And Chuck said to me, "Look, if you're ever in California, give me a call. and we'll do some training, which again, to a kid in Australia was like, wow, how, you know, it doesn't get any better than that.
Mm-hmm.
So when Linda Ronstadt, you know, asked me to come and work for her in California in 79, off I went, and Chuck was the first person I called. And that's how I started training every morning at his house. He had a gym at his house, and he was in pre-production then for the Octagon movie. And because in Australia I'd been doing demonstration with various Okinawan weapons, and Chuck knew I could handle the weapons, of course, if people remember Octagon, it involved sort of ninja and everything else, and there was a role for Keo, who was the main mask sort of ninja, and, you know, it called for a big fight scene at the end. You know, we used Sai against Katana and various other things, and he asked me if I would play that role. And that was really how it started. It was through meeting Chuck Norris that I got my intro into the movie business. And I started that, and I remember thinking at the time, wow, this is a cool way to make a living, because I'm on the set with, you know, Simon and Philip Ree, who are just unbelievable Taekwondo masters, Tadashi Yamashita, who is just an unbelievable Shorin-Ryu martial artist, who I trained with for a couple of years afterwards. In other words, I was in an environment sort of getting paid to sort of meet some of the best martial artists in the country. And I thought, this is great. So I ended up doing a number of movies with Chuck. I got my first lead role in Force 5 in 1981. We shot that. And, you know, I had to go and audition for that one. That was Fred Weintraub and Bob Klaus, who were the producers and director of Enter the Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to audition, and I remember getting down to 10 people and realizing I'm still one of the 10, even though there's a couple of hundred people auditioned. And I got one of the leads, and that was when I thought, wow, there could be a bit of a career here. Because I started, when I first went to the audition, I remember thinking, well, why me? Why would I get the role? I'm Australian. You know, I have an accent and blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
But as when I did get the role, I changed my attitude from, instead of why me, it was became why not me. You know, I've changed it to everybody else, and off I went. So, you know, to date, they're not all listed on IMBD, but I've probably done 70 movies now, and a lot of them we call B-grade movies, but honestly, it's fine. You know, I worked in the Philippines and Kazakhstan, Thailand and Croatia, and all over the world, and I thought, boy, you can't get a better life than that, just doing what you love doing. In other words, still doing your martial arts, but in the medium of film. And still going, you know, my last movie I just worked for, I was in Namibia last year from May until December, working on the latest Mad Max movie with Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy. I was a fight coordinator as well as playing a role. That one will come out in July next year. So I guess even now it ain't over till it's over. There's still a bit of life left in me as far as that genre. So it's pretty cool stuff. And
that is,
again,
excellent.
As a result of just having a passion for the martial arts. So about that.
Well, very, very cool. Now, Richard, you've done some fight scenes with some incredible artists. Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, Don Wilson. What fight scene is your most memorable?
Oh, well, they're all memorable for different reasons. You know, of course, you know, doing stuff with Chuck Norris, just because he's such an icon, you know, the industry, and such a dear friend, you know, it means a lot to me just from that point of view. To do that fight in the Octagon, which was right up there with one of the all-time best fight scenes in film, only because of when we did it was quite new, you know, groundbreaking, that style of fight using ninja stuff and everything else. Of course, it's all gone to a whole different level now, but that meant a lot to me, being my first movie. We shot that in Indian Dunes at about 4 a.m. in the morning, and I just think the result was phenomenal. Working with Jackie Chan, of course, again, being such a maestro of the martial arts is a highlight. I did three movies with Jackie where I was the lead bad guy. And my first fight, the most memorable fight, is still fighting Sammo Hung, who, for those who don't know, was like the Steven Spielberg of Hong Kong movies at that stage. This is in the 80s. And Sammo was like big brother to Jackie. You know, they have a pecking order, and Yuen Biel was like little brother, and then you had Jackie. Well, Sammo was kind of like Jackie's senior in a sense, and my first fight in a film called Twinkle Twinkle Lucky Stars was with Sammo, and I remember going over thinking, yeah, this will be all right, and I was working out the sort of techniques I would like to do. Well, and working 12-hour days, which I expected, you know, well, I got a rude awakening, because when I fought Sammo, it took 3.5 weeks to shoot that fight, and I was on the set 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. I literally got 2 hours sleep a night, aside from trying to curl up in the set and get a few, you know, winks. And you're fighting the whole time, you know, all day long. And the contact was excessive, especially to the body, even copying bare-fisted uppercuts under the chin.
Mm.
That was the way they did it then. And I remember, and the timing was different and everything was different. And plus, they didn't care what you wanted to do. It's what they choreographed. They meaning, you know, the Hong Kong choreographers, in particularly Sammo. And so it was that was quite a culture shock for me. I remember getting to my room 3 days into this fight, and I said out loud, if I can get through this, I can get through anything. And I really meant it. And I got through it. I got on so well with Sammo and Jackie. You know, Jackie took me shopping everywhere. And it was because of that movie they ended up doing another I did another movie with Andy there was another actor anyway that was just starting out into the business, and did a film with him, did one with Sammo, did another couple with Jackie. And it wasn't because I was any better than any other martial artist, you know, not by a long stretch. It's just because they knew I understood how they worked. I would kind of keep my mouth shut. If they wanted 30 takes of something, I would just do it over and over. I was always in shape, particularly back then. I was willing to take the bumps and the knocks. And so it just suited the bill as far as what they wanted. And so that whole thing was just an incredible experience. And for anyone that thinks working with Jackie is fun, it's not fun when you're doing it. Because it's like they say about comedians, when you hang out with a comedian, they're not funny all the time. You know, that's their business. That's what they do. And they're very serious about it. And Jackie's exactly the same. He's a workaholic and such a perfectionist. So it's very demanding being on set and working with them, especially in the Hong Kong movie days, because I was a guailo, you know. I was the only one that's, except for Jackie and a little bit from Sammo, that spoke English. It was kind of like you and them. And so it was tough. But always looking back on what you did, you just go, wow, what an incredible experience, you know.
Wow, especially in Hong Kong. In the Hong Kong film industry, that's tough. I mean,
And their stunt groups, you know, they're very competitive. There's a few top stunt groups around, and oh man, it was just like, how can we outdo each other? And it really was culture shock, because it was such a different environment for me as far as movies, and I learned so much from them. You know, back then, their style of shooting wasn't still accepted in the U.S. You had your old Chinese movies and people flying all over the place, but it was not really acceptable. And, you know, their idea of camera placement, constantly moving the camera and just shooting maybe 3, 4, 5 moves and then changing camera and then going in a different direction was very unique, not to them. They'd been doing for ages, but as far as what an American audience were used to was quite unique. And then Rumble in the Bronx came out and a few of those pictures, and suddenly they, you know, that style of Hong Kong movie making was really embraced by the US. So again, to be a part of that era, and, you know, especially back in the 80s, was, again, it's just phenomenal looking back. You know, I look back at old pictures on the set with Jackie and with Sammo and Yuen Biu and people like this, and you're like, wow, that's quite something, you know, to have been accepted into that inner circle.
Indeed. Now, the movies that I've seen with you in it, you've played several different types of characters. You played the bad guy, you played detectives, the good guy. As a martial arts action star, did you feel that that there was like a type of role that producers felt you were more suited for, or did you feel like you were typecast in any way, depending on what country?
Not really. Like, obviously, if you do a movie in Hong Kong with someone like Jackie, then you're the bad guy.
Oh,
I mean, they wanted the bigger, wilder, the Westerner to fight and everything, and you know, you were never going to be the big guy there. So that was just accepted. As far as America and everything, you know, the China O'Brien movies that I did with mm-hmm. Cynthia Rothrock and Raging Honor 1 and 2 and all those sorts of movies, you know, I played the good guy. That was an easy bill for me to fill. Bad guy roles, really, I was quite happy to play those too, because there were a lot of careers of actors playing good villains, and villains are actually more fun because you could kind of do anything as the villain, because, you know, if the audience kind of wanted to see you get beaten up in the end, you'd done your job, you know. We always joke that the only problem with playing the bad guy is you never win the fight in the end and you never get the leading lady. So there you go. But, you know, I didn't mind playing either. And, you know, and I was told very early, Laura, you should hold out for better roles and bigger movies. But honestly, it wasn't that important to me. I liked the movies. For me, were a way of economically making money enough to carry me through spending more time in the dojo. You know, mm-hmm. It was really a means to an end, meaning I wasn't as passionate about acting as I was about martial arts. If I had been as passionate about acting, then I would have been in acting schools more and becoming a better actor and really following that path. But it just wasn't as important to me. And I'm one of about 3%, they reckon, of the Screen Actors Guild members that actually made a living out of acting. They reckon 3%, if you average it out, all the wages, made a full-time living. 10% did it with a second job, and the rest forget about it. Mm-hmm. So to be in that small percentage was great. And again, for me, it was about just the people I met, the countries I traveled to, and the friendships I made, not so much about the quality of the work. I mean, maybe I should have been more concerned with that, but, you know, I'm still quite content with the choices I made, you know. We can always look back in hindsight and say, oh, gee, imagine one if I could have held out for more A-grade roles. But mm-hmm. the risk then was, if you got offered a job, you always figured you might never get another job after that one. So
right.
You were very eager to say, yeah, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
right. Absolutely. Now, Richard, in August 2010, you appeared at the Berlin Movie Con with some martial arts icons, you know, Cynthia Rothrock and so forth. How did you get involved with that? And tell us a little bit about that and your appearance.
You know what? I'd be hard-pressed to remember how I got involved. I'd been to Germany times earlier for a Budo Gala that a gentleman named Norbert Schiffer arranged. I actually went there some years before with Kathy Long and did some demonstrations with some incredible people. Ernie Reyes Jr. was there, and, you know, Obata-sensei was there, and blah, blah, blah. It was a huge, huge event of the best martial artists in the world. I imagine somehow that got me some exposure in the country. And the Berlin one was really about just sort of martial art movie stars, if you will, and Matthias Hughes and Don Wilson and a whole slew of people were invited over to attend that event. And that was great. I loved it because, you know, we got a chance to sort of get together as a bunch, which is hard to do. We always say when we do movies, oh, let's keep in touch. We'll see each other. And you hardly ever do. You kind of take phone numbers and then you go about your own lives. So an event like the Berlin event is wonderful that we're all in one place at the one time, you know, over a space of a week. And, you know, as you know, I must have done 9 movies with Cynthia Rothrock, you know, such a dear friend. And so, again, for us all to hang out like that, Jeff Spiekerman was there. It goes on. And Olivier Gruner, it was just a great time to get all of us together in one spot and just have a laugh and reminisce about some of the times we spent together in the past.
Right.
Wow. Now, are there people that you have kept in touch with, like Cynthia and Chuck and those guys, or have you all gone your separate ways?
Oh, no. I definitely, you know, I just had lunch with Cynthia when I was in L.A. a month ago. And, you know, Chuck Norris was best man at my wedding. We're still incredibly close friends. I'm now on the Chuck Norris team. He's representing Max International, which is an incredible health product. You know, that mm-hmm. That's another story, of course. For anyone that's interested, by the way, just look up a product called Riboscene, and there's Max International. If anyone Googles that and gets some information, I don't push that sort of stuff. I don't make a living out of products, but they've got a product called Cellgevity, and it's It's a product called glutathione, which the body naturally produces, but you can't get it from foods or anything. And after 20, every 5 or 10 years of your life, it drops by 10%. So this particular product that Chuck is a spokesperson for, this ribosine, you know, you take some tablets and everything, and improves and increases by 300 to 400% the amount of glutathione your body produces. And it's all about attacking inflammation at the cellular level. And for those who don't, without going into detail, this you know, cellular inflammation is responsible for Alzheimer's and arthritis and just about any ailment, asthma, anything you can think of has its roots in inflammation. So to have a product like glutathione and a product with this ribosine from Max International that helps your body produce glutathione, I just couldn't recommend it more. So I encourage people, just look up glutathione online and you'll get an idea. I bring that up just because Chuck and I are still always involved in things that we believe are really good for the community, and especially in our martial arts world. If there's something that I really believe in, and I wouldn't even be talking about it if I hadn't tried it and actually can, you know, confirm the results and everything of this product, I just like to share that information. I went to Chuck's convention. They flew me over for the UFAP convention last July. That's the United Fighting Arts Federation that Chuck still heads up. I went and taught some seminars there and got the hang. And I've actually been teaching at the UFAP convention since 1980, if you can believe it. So to be still part of the Chuck Norris family and Chum Kuk Do and the UFAP Federation is fantastic, because there's no better or closer role model for me than Mr. Chuck Norris. He's just a wonderful human being. So there you go. So, you know, as far as Don Wilson, we're always contacting each other on Facebook. I saw Jeff Speakman not all that long ago, Bill Wallace. So it's not so much that I search them out, but we're always running into each other at events all over the place. And it's just great to reestablish those ties and those friendships. And once again, it's like that silent language of martial arts that brings us all together the way it does.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I just looked up glutathione, and wow, this is the big mother of all antioxidants. It says that it's naturally occurring, but it's hard to get it through food.
Yeah, your body won't get it from the digestion of food, which is why they've got a patent on this product, this ingredient called ribosine. That's in Cellgevity, which is the tablets, is an ATP product, which is, you know, a pre-workout. You know, you mix it in water and everything, and it's like a pre-workout and post-workout drink. And I'm telling you, again, it's too, you know, we wouldn't want to bore people going to it now, but you should go on, look up Max International, or, you know, you can go on. I have a Max International site. If people wanted to sort of buy a product under me, I'd appreciate it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, it's all multi-marketing. But again, I preface that by saying that I wouldn't be pushing the idea of something that I didn't believe in. I just don't do that out of integrity and morality. I wouldn't do it. But this is an incredible product, and it's groundbreaking. And again, if you just read about glutathione, I can't imagine any athlete not being sold on the idea of at least giving it a try.
Yeah, I'm reading all sorts of studies now, and that's incredible. I definitely will check that out.
Wonderful.
All right, I guess we'll go back to the interview so the listeners don't go, okay, all right,
yes,
move on.
And again, apologies to anybody. I'm not, as I said, it's not the idea to just go on and push marketing, but again, it's a great product. Give it a try. I don't make a living out of those sorts of things, so it's up to the individual to decide. But, you know, look it up.
Exactly. But I do suggest our listeners do look up Master Norton's site, Max International, because the more I'm reading about ribosine and glutathione, it's kind of like, oh, my gosh, I wonder if I should get into this. I think I should.
Well, and here's the other thing I might tell you. One thing I know about Chuck Norris is that he has integrity second to none. And they did like 8 months of due diligence on the product, on the research, on everything else. And for Chuck to put his name on the line to back a product, it certainly would never be done without, you know, without integrity. And that means a lot. And And I really mean it. Like, he's not going to just say, oh, yeah, I'll put my name to it because there's some money to be made. It's not about that for him. And that's an incredible stamp of approval right there. For anyone that knows the type of person that Chuck, if you don't know him, you know he's never come across as anyone lacking morality or integrity. And as I said, for him to put his name to something, there's got to be something to it. So it's definitely worth a look.
Exactly, exactly. So listeners, that's Max International. All right. Now, you had spent a lot of time in front of the camera, but also put in a lot of time behind the scenes as a fight choreographer. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that part of your career?
Yes. Well, that just kind of happened as a natural course of events. You know, again, through being with Chuck, we always trained to choreograph fights, put them together the way we would work out in the mornings was very much in mind. Doing a fight scene that would work for camera. So I gained a lot of knowledge in that area. And whenever the opportunity came up to do some fight choreography or stunt coordinating, I was able to do it because I did my homework and also realized that the more hats you could put on, the better the longevity or your lasting in this sort of area of entertainment. I was in Lithuania for 4 years as a second unit director and fight coordinator in a series and as well as acting. I just now, as I said, finished being a co-fight coordinator on the latest Mad Max movie as well as playing a role. I was fight coordinator on The Condemned with Stone Cold Steve Austin, and been a lot of movies. So I enjoy that process. For me, it's really, I don't really mind what the role, as long as it's an enjoyable film or movie or project, then I'm more than happy to be involved, whether it's in front of or behind the camera. And, you know, unfortunately, the older you get, the less roles you're going to get offered for obvious reasons. I would rather have the 30-year-old hunky dudes running around. And that's fine. I totally understand that. And as I said, luckily I was smart enough to gain a lot of knowledge in what it means to be behind the camera, as in the fight and stunt coordinating world of filmmaking. So, I enjoy that very much as well.
Very cool.
Very cool. Now, Richard, I understand this year you did a little television. Which do you prefer? Did you take the job to take the job, or is it something you always wanted to get into for TV?
No, it really is a job. It's a job is a job is a job. You know, television is not as fun because it's so fast. You know, it's very fast paced. Movies, you have a lot of hang time. You know, you can sort of, not so much coast depending on the budget, but television, you know, if you're referring to Spartacus, you know, I got offered a, you know, ongoing role, but I was already committed to Mad Max. You know, I had to go to Namibia. As I said, I was there from May until December last year in the Namibian desert. So the Spartacus was for the first episode of season 3. Hilaris was my character, and I loved it. I was so blown away with the production value of that show. Stars, you know, the production company, and I tell you, the state-of-the-art cameras and everything else and the way it was all set up was just incredible. So, and wonderful actors, wonderful people, and we shot that in New Zealand, and that was just literally a week and a half before I went to Namibia that we did that. The only downside is I get killed with my own sword. I was like, that little chestnut, should have seen that coming. but it was just great. You know, it was just another great experience to be working with a wonderful set of stunties, you know, stunt players there and actors. And again, it's a job. You know, I wouldn't just take any job. I might say I still would like to have some morality in the type of roles I choose, though it would be nice to know that you could just choose and, you know, pick and choose whatever you played. But within reason, you know, bad guy roles are good. There's some areas I won't go into, you know, violence on women on screen and everything else. I think there's a line we shouldn't cross, but that's just me. I understand actors act, and that's their job. And if the role sort of calls for certain things to be portrayed as a character on camera, then that's what you do. And, you know, but again, if I get offered a TV series or role, I would be putting my hand up and saying thank you very much. You know.
Now I have a Mad Max question for you. Is Mad Max still filmed in Australia? And it's not still Mel Gibson, is it?
No, it's not. Tom Hardy is the Max character. Tom played Bane in the latest Batman movie. He did Inception with Leonardo DiCaprio. He's a wonderful actor. He's done a lot of movies, loves Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and just such a cutting-edge actor. And he's playing the Max character. It's not like a follow-on, though you will see him looking the same way as we last saw Mel.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just another story in that post-apocalyptic era, you know. And again, it's such a good movie, this one. I didn't particularly like number three that much, but this one is like Road Warrior, which is the second one. But as the stunt coordinator rightfully pointed out, it's like Road Warrior on steroids. I mean, the cars and the trucks are so souped up, twin V8s, incredible stunts and crashes, and they're all real. It's not all full of CGI and special effects, and, you know, just a wonderful, wonderful bunch of actors.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's going to be, it's out, as I said, it'll be coming out in July next year. We've got to go to Sydney and shoot just some more pickups. And by the way, to answer your question, Bob, it was shot in Namibia, but it's not tied down to any location. You know, it's just somewhere in this post-apocalyptic world that George Miller created. It's not set in Australia, even though it seemed to be that because of Mel being an Aussie and having an Aussie accent.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Got it. Okay.
Very cool.
So nowadays, I know that, you know, you're traveling all over the place, but is there something in particular that you're concentrating on now? Is it movies that you want to get more into, TV, seminars, teaching?
Yes, teaching and seminars is more my focus, though I still totally love the idea of movies and film work, not giving up that hat yet while somebody still wants me. But I'm setting up Team Norton Alliance, we're calling it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have Team Norton Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. It's my own sort of association with people and affiliate and associate. I have a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu curriculum that people can incorporate into the schools, and my job then is to oversee their gradings and do seminars. The same with, there's a site called Tactical MMA, TMMA.
Mm-hmm.
That's my friend Jeremy Tacody and I have an MMA curriculum of 5 different levels. That will be an online training curriculum that people can log on. It'll be like $25 a month, and you mm-hmm. can just access training drills and information, all leading to certification under Tactical MMA logo. And again, following it up with seminars. I love the seminars. You know, I teach a lot of seminars. I'm a 4th degree black belt under Jean-Jacques Machado.
Mm-hmm.
I've been with Machados for more 25, 26 years. They're just the most phenomenal Brazilian jiu-jitsu coaches you could ever have. And I've been with Jean-Jacques for a long time, so he's my professor. My master in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I love doing BJJ seminars, but I also do more traditional training drill seminars as well as street reality-based combat mm-hmm. seminars and kickboxing. You know, I'm a level 6 with Benny the Jet Urquidez in kickboxing. So really, it's whatever anybody wants, and I love it. You know, and it keeps me sharp. Every time there's a seminar, I've got to pull my finger out and make sure I'm in shape and able to keep up with whatever's out there in the martial arts world, and so it keeps me going. You know, I love it. And again, very soon, if anyone's interested, just Google me. There's a mock site at the moment, but I don't have any stuff up there yet, you know, with Team Norton Alliance. But Tactical MMA, all of that's about to be launched literally in a matter of weeks. So if anyone's interested, keep an eye out for that.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Indeed. Mm. Now, if there are any youth that want to get into martial arts and you were having to talk to them, what advice would you give the youth of today in getting into martial arts?
Yeah, I think the best advice is to find something that you can form a foundation in. And what do I mean by that? See, you know, when I start, as I say to people, we only did one thing. You either did karate or you boxed or you wrestled or you did judo. Now it's an MMA world, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of kids think of MMA as UFC. Well, UFC is still just a sport version of mixing martial arts. There's mm-hmm. still rules. The amount of people that get in a cage with their backs up against the wire are getting punched in every little gloves is probably one in a thousand. So the MMA that I like to focus on is more combat MMA, what would work in the real world. Having said that, a kid needs to really just decide, go and really do your homework and go into an Aikido school or a Judo school or a BJJ school or an MMA school and really just have a look at the classes and just see what really seems to gel with you. It's almost like a gut instinct and go with that. But don't try and do too many things at once because you will absolutely become a jack of all trades, master mm-hmm. of none. I believe you should get a foundation in a striking art, you know, and then supplement it accordingly, or get a really good foundation in, say, Brazilian jiu-jitsu and then supplement it with a striking art
mm-hmm.
and sort of, but have a base art that you focus on and become very, very good at and then start to go from there. Or as I say to people, it took me 35 years to get good at one thing. I don't mm-hmm. know how you get good at Muay Thai and BJJ and karate and everything else in the space of a week. I don't know how you do it. So focus on that. And also just really honestly ask yourself why you're doing it. Are you doing it for self-defense, for confidence, for fitness, to become an artist, you know, in whatever sense of the word, to become a forms champion? All of those will help you decide what the best style, you know, of martial art is for you. You know, a lot of the kids are doing extreme, you know, mm-hmm. with all the tricks and flipping, and my body even hurts looking at that. I spend a bit of time with my cat's in Australia at the moment, and just a wonderful, wonderful mm-hmm. martial artist and person, and I look at what he does, and I'm like, forget about it. But for the kids, it's, you know, the athleticism is phenomenal. So, again, there's a lot to choose from. Just really do the homework, and before you waste a lot of time and money in both, just try and at least narrow it down to something you believe you would want to spend some time with and get some longevity out of.
That's wonderful advice. Because there's like so many. It is, because there's so many kids out there that like you said, you know, they think that mixed martial arts is UFC. And they think, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to learn how to do a short arm bar, you know, do a Kimura, and boom, I'm in. But if they don't have that background of knowing how to strike or take a hit or even kick, then it's, you know, in a way it's like, oh, it can be disappointing for them. So that's wonderful advice.
Yeah, and I also would say that, you know, for a while there, everything was based on, well, will it really work in the
yeah.
street? That gets a bit old, too. Mm-hmm. I would think that it doesn't take that long for you to have suitable skills, not against a seasoned street fighter, but against the average Joe Blow.
Mm-hmm.
So get those skills under your belt. And Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu will help you that. You need a grappling game as well as a stand-up game. But even basic rudimentary boxing will give you pretty much the striking skills you need. And, again, I'm not talking about an experienced fighter, but the average person. And then accept that there's so much enjoyment in the art. I mean, look at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, De La Riva and Baron Bolo and all these different things they do on the ground. It's illogical in the street that I'd be on my back doing all of that against one person while the other three are kicking the crap out of my head, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't excuse that. I just love being on the mat and having my body behave in the most excellent manner using leverage and timing and this physical, you know, chess game that we're playing on the mat in the safety of the dojo is an incredibly enjoyable way to spend your time. It's in the moment. It's mind, body, spirit. It's all of that. So don't lose sight of the art and mm-hmm. the enjoyment of the art. I mean, look at even traditional karate and bunkai. Mm-hmm. A lot of it I don't see as that relevant to today's combat world, but boy, is it, it's just wonderful to do. It's wonderful mm-hmm. for your mind. It's wonderful for your body. So, you know, have a balance as far as that goes too.
Awesome. Beautiful advice.
Cool. Well, Richard, you know, if our listeners want to get a hold of you for seminars, teaching, training, how would they go about doing that?
Well, I have a website. It's www.richardnorton.net. But the best way, if people just take down an email, it's rjnorton@earthlink.net. rjnorton@earthlink.net.
Mm-hmm.
I'll always be able to reach me there. Just drop me an email with details and I'll get back to them. The other way, of course, is Facebook. The only thing is that I've got, I don't know, 5,000 with another 2,000 in line. And, you know, as you know, I don't know most of those people. It's more of a marketing tool. But I believe you can still always message me on Facebook. I think you don't even have to be, as it were, a friend to get a message. And that's another great way to get in touch is look me up on Facebook, Richard Norton. And I'll definitely get back to anybody because I'm open to go anywhere for seminars. I love it. And I'm at the stage of life where I know I can't take it to the grave with me. So the more I can sort of pass over and pass on some of my knowledge, the happier I am.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful outlook for teachers, for all teachers, as opposed to like hoarding it. So that's so awesome. Wow. Well, Master Norton, I know that you've got a rest of a busy day. So we'll go ahead and end our interview here. So, wow, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to join us today.
Well, my pleasure, Bob and Restita. Thank you for having me. And listen, we'll do it again sometime. You know, we've only tip of the iceberg, lots to talk about. But,
exactly. I was thinking the same thing. I was hoping we could probably do a part two sometime in the future.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot. I love to talk about integrity within the arts and morality and a sense of honor, which a lot of it's missing in a lot of our arts. And another time we'll get into that, but that's very dear to my heart. That's why role models like Chuck Norris and Benny the Jet Urquidez and, of course, Jean-Jacques Machado, these sort of people really walk the talk. And I'd love to talk about those sort of character traits that that it's so important that we as martial artists really act responsibly in that world.
I agree.
And again, for those listeners, thank you for tuning in, anyone that has. And as I said, get in touch with me, any questions. Do me a favor, look up glutathione.
You bet.
Your point of view, and look up Richard Norton and Max International. I'm not even sure how you find me on that, but you will. You'll find Max International. Any questions on anything like that, let me know.
You bet. You bet. I'm going to be checking that out because I'm feeling kind of old. And I'm not. That's the thing. And it's kind of like there's got to be something going on. So definitely I'll check that out. And definitely it's on me and Bob's subject list to talk a little bit more about honor and integrity in the martial arts in today's world. So we'd love to have you on for that and some other people also. But we'll get in touch with you about that when we get that subject on the roll call for our next show.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, listeners, if you didn't get a chance to call, you missed out.
Yes. Oh, man.
You missed out. If you're just now tuning in, this is the Dynamic Dojo radio show on Blog Talk Radio with Restita and Robert. And we just spoke with Master Richard Norton, actor and martial artist, who spoke with us for the last hour and 15 minutes. So, wow, that's pretty cool. And for those of you that were wondering, we are going to do a regular segment of health news and weird news and stuff like that. We just wanted to make sure Master Norton spoke with us first because we knew he had a busy day ahead of him. Because it's like noon something over there. It's like almost 1 o'clock. Or is it 1 o'clock? No, it's like 12. Yeah, it's about 12:15 over there. So Master Norton had to get to classes and go on with his busy day. So, but let's get right into what would have been our first segment. Let's do it. So let's see here. Let's get into birthdays. And you came up with all these birthdays. I didn't get a chance to look for any because I was like running around with my head cut off like a chicken for the last couple of days. What birthdays do you have for us?
Well, we have a contributor, weekly contributor sometimes to the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page, and he has a great blog out there. On 9/22, it's Rob Buckland's birthday, which is today.
Happy birthday, Rob.
What day it was. Tomorrow is our good friend Dan Heck, the CEO of the Masters Hall of Fame. His birthday is tomorrow.
Oh, right on.
A personal friend of mine, Brandon Correa. He's somebody I nurtured and helped to get his Eagle Scout and spoke at his Eagle Scout ceremony. Then we have our good friend from 29 Palms, Crystal Carter, Master Craig Carter's daughter. Her birthday is on the 24th, along with Brandon. And my old golf instructor, Zachary Allen, turns another year older on the 26th of the month.
Wow. Awesome. Happy birthday, everybody. I'm just kind of looking down the list here to see if I have any friends with birthdays. Oh, I do have some friends with birthdays. On Friday the 27th, one of my great friends and fellow whip maker and whip artist, Maya Espinosa, is having a birthday. And for anyone that's looking for a great quality whip, Maya can whip it out. No pun intended.
Did you really just say that?
Yeah, whip it out as far as speed. I didn't mean it the other way. Jeez. I guess I should have thought about that. But
wow.
But okay, so Maya can really make a whip very quickly. If you order a whip, he can get it done pretty much the same day, depending on when you place an order. I kid you not. And I have a couple of his whips. A lot of my group has some of his whips, so go check him out. Maya Espinosa, and that's Espinosa with a Z at the end. So happy birthday, Maya. One of my longtime students, Aaron Burt, is having a birthday that same day on the 27th. And another one of my former students, Corky Davis, is having a birthday. Let's see. Who else do we have here? I think that's it. Yes, that's it until next Sunday. Wow, right on. So I've got a special tune for everyone having a birthday this week. This one's for you. Right. Happy birthday, everyone. Now, if you're not a member of the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page and you know someone in the martial arts community or the health and fitness realm or whatever that is having a birthday and you want us to do a shout-out for them, just get on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page and let us know, and we will give a shout-out for them for their birthday.
Now, there are some other things on the page, though, they have to be aware of. We are trying to vote for Seattle Wushu Center to be the Western Washington number one martial arts school.
Oh, thanks for the plug, bro. Yes, I'll go ahead and tell the listeners a little bit about that. I was actually surprised about this because one of my students, Annette, who owns a, I don't quite know what type of business I could label it under, but technically she would be under waxing. For like grooming services and stuff like that. But she does sugaring, which doesn't use wax. It uses like a sugar type of a gel or a paste. And the results are better from what I've heard than waxing. And she actually had won the top spot in the Best of Western Washington for her business, the Seattle Sugar Bar. And she nominated me. Just out of the blue, I had no idea until I found out on Facebook. I was tagged in a post or something like that, and I went to go check it out, and then I realized I was actually nominated on King 5 TV's Best of Western Washington contest. And it's a vote. It's based on votes. Seattle Wushu Center, my studio, is currently in second place, and there's another studio in first place. And it's just based on votes. So if anyone out there wants to vote, just go to the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page, and there should be a post up there somewhere about the Best of Western Washington. There should be several. And I'd really appreciate the support, listeners, because for the last, since 1998 or so, I've been pretty much keeping under the radar. I've had a commercial school since 1991, but since 1998, 1999, late 90s. I've kept under the radar. We haven't been competing as much. I mean, I've still done community service and community demos and kept very active in the community and serving the Seattle community, especially the West Seattle community. But I've just pretty much kept under the radar. I, you know, didn't market as much and stuff like that. And I woke up one day and realized, wow, you know, I really need to, you know, get my name out there more. Because like Richard says, you know, I don't want to go to the grave not giving away the knowledge. Because, you know, I'm always reminded that I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. And I want to be able to share the art with as many youth, especially, and adults as possible. You know, because you never know. You never know, you know. So I'd like to get back into the public eye a little bit. And listeners, if you're listening and would like to vote, please do. I'd appreciate your support. And you don't have to be from Washington State to vote. You just click the link on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page or my personal profile and place your vote under Best Martial Arts, not under Best CrossFit or Best Gym. I don't know how I got nominated for Best CrossFit because I know nothing about CrossFit, or Best Gym because I have nothing to do with, you know, gym, you know, like Gold's Gym or, you know, 24-hour fitness or anything like that. So, you know, please vote for that. Thanks for the plug, Robert. I appreciate it. So with that said, let's move on to some fun
weird
stuff.
Weird news.
Yeah, well, weird news.
This is about as weird as it gets.
Okay.
Sergio Cinez, 18, and a 17-year-old accomplice broke into a mobile home in Chaparral, New Mexico last month, pilfering multiple DVDs related to, get this, midget porn.
Wait a minute. What? Okay. Sorry.
According to a criminal complaint obtained by the Smoking Gun. Now, the Smoking Gun is a newspaper. And published Tuesday, the complaint was what used the word midget. This term is typically considered offensive, with dwarves preferring to be called little people.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know exactly why you prefer to be called, Rusty.
Oh, shut up. Shut up. Oh, my God. Okay, wait. It deserves a rim shot. It does. Okay, all right. But that we're not insulting the little people. That was just a slam on me, everyone.
No.
So we got to make that, you know, PC. He wasn't slamming.
No, I'm insulting you.
Yeah, me. Exactly. Anyway, go on. Don't make me make light bulb jokes.
Oh.
Boom.
Ooh,
damn.
Yeah,
okay.
The Richard stick the knife in, you salted the wound. The two also allegedly stole electronics, kitchen appliances, and a mirror before setting. Now, this is the weird part of the weird part. Not just the porn. They set the house on fire.
What?
They burned it. Yeah. Cinez was charged with burglary, arson, breaking and entering, and contributing to the delinquency of a minor because, of course, his accomplice was 17. He is scheduled to appear in court on September 23rd. Now, with more than 1.2 million years of porn available for free on the Internet, it's pretty surprising that anyone is breaking into homes to steal. Apparently they are. In February, a connoisseur had $7,500 worth of porn films stolen from his Michigan home. Don't worry, though. He got it back.
Not that I was worried, but still.
Yeah, exactly.
That's crazy.
That is nuts. And this is what always kills me about the police. I know they have a job to do and all this, but it's like they tack on all these charges, but a lot of them sound the same. Breaking and entering and burglary.
Right. Well, I guess entering has to deal more with the property or the property that they had to break before they got to the other property. But wow, a whole bunch of porn.
Sheep, they are insane.
Wow.
And she was stalling while she found that button.
That is some weird news, man.
Now, I'm going to go into weird laws. Now, I did weird laws from Australia this week because of our guest, of course, being the great Master Richard Norton.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Australia, it is illegal to roam the streets wearing black clothes, felt shoes, and black shoe polish on your face, as these items are the tools of a cat burglar. It is illegal to walk on the right hand. Oh, I'm sorry, that's a separate law. But the next law is it is illegal to walk on the right-hand side of a footpath. I guess a footpath to them is a trail or a sidewalk.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Under Australian Communications Authority, ACA, regulates a modem can't pick up on the first ring. How weird is that?
Yeah, and how do they police that, I wonder?
I know.
Oh, your modem ran twice.
Yeah, it picked it up on the first ring. You got to, no, I don't think so.
Yeah,
taxi cabs are required to carry a bale of hay in the trunk.
Hmm.
Well, that sucks.
Hmm.
Bars. Now, this sort of explains why the next one. You. If you wonder why this will sort of, not totally explain, sort of shed some light on it, though. Bars are required to stable, water, and feed horses of their patrons.
Boy, they haven't taken that off the books.
Well, the bale of the hay and the... And I'm sure Australia still has a lot of open land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, probably still a ton, more so than the United States, unless you're like way in the middle Midwest somewhere. Not like you're going to get that in California, that's for sure, or Washington. Well, of course, Washington probably has more open land than we do.
Yeah, definitely.
The legal age for straight sex is 16, unless the person in the care custody of the older person is, in which case it is 18.
Wait, well, okay, what?
Let me read that again.
Yeah, what?
The legal age for straight sex is 16. Unless the person is in the care or custody of the older person. Oh, so if you've got a guardian, maybe it's not related to you, and you're going to have sex with that person, you have to be
18. That makes no sense, because the legal age is 16.
Right. Unless you're under care of the person you're having sex with.
That's weird.
I had to read that again. I'm sorry.
It still makes no sense. Well, you can have sex at 16 unless there's someone older that you're under the custody of. But then you have to be 18 if someone else is claiming you to be under their custody. That makes no friggin' sense at all, but that's why it's a weird law. Okay.
Right. Now, this one is sort of strange. Only licensed electricians can change a light bulb.
Okay.
That's it. Nobody else.
Nobody else. So
it is illegal to wear hot pink pants after midday on Sunday.
What the hell?
In Australia, a life sentence when you're put in prison is only 25 years.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Whoa. So you kill somebody, they say, okay, you're in prison for life, but it's only 25 years.
Only a quarter of a century. That's right.
Wow.
You must have a neck-to-knee swimsuit in order to swim at Brighton Beach.
Wow.
Children may not purchase cigarettes, but they may smoke them.
It's kind of like our weed law here in Washington State.
Exactly. You can smoke it and you can carry it. You just can't buy it.
Yeah, go figure, right? Which means you're still breaking the law to get it. Okay.
To get it, right. Until the Port Arthur killings, it was legal to own an AK-47, but not legal to be gay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That's a stupid law as opposed to weird, but that's just me.
Right. You may never leave your car keys in an unattended vehicle.
Okay. That
lawmakers are proposing a new law that will not allow anyone to come closer than 100 meters from a dead whale's carcass.
Now that one's weird.
I know. Are you like kidding me? Really?
Right. Oh my gosh, that's funny. Wow. Man. Was that it for Australia?
That was it for Australia.
Whoa, well, I guess that was Bob.
Weird news.
All right, let's get right into the health news. Here we go. All right. Now, this particular story is going to be posted on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page here in a couple seconds. Now, we all know that exercise is good for you, and there are many studies that say that exercise is good for you. And here's just news about another study in that keeping active could be the secret to staying young for both mice and men. Researchers from Canada's McMaster University discovered that endurance exercise could halt the aging process in a group of mice, even though they were genetically engineered to age faster. Now, I'm going to read on here because I found this pretty interesting. The mice continued to exhibit the same youthful appearance as normal mice after engaging in a treadmill exercise routine over a period of several months. In addition, the exercise program prevented premature aging in almost every organ of these genetically engineered mice. Details on the mighty mice, that's what they called them, details on the mighty mice can be found in the journal. Wow. Now, according to lead study author Mark Tarnopolsky, who is a professor of pediatrics and medicine at McMaster's DeGroote School of Medicine, he says, what really shocked us were the gonads, the spleen and liver. Almost every tissue we looked at was made better with the exercise. It has a systemic effect and even prevented a slight shrinkage of the brain. So the good news is that it's never too late to get on that treadmill. Dr. Tarnopolsky notes that studies have shown that even those who have spent far too much time being sedentary can still reap the benefits of exercise and gain energy, mobility, and promote healthier organs. Now take the doc's advice to get moving, get active, and get your kids moving while they're young. The road to fitness may just lead to the fountain of youth. So get to exercising, folks. Get away from the video games and the junk food and sitting in front of the TV all day. Get off the computer all day and get moving. I think that's one of the reasons why I chose to quit the corporate job that I had and teach martial arts full time. It's because, number one, it was something I wanted to do. Number two, you know, what better job to wake up in the morning and go, yay, I get to go to work and get exercise. So that's awesome. Get on the treadmill, folks.
Absolutely. Oh, and I wanted to bring up something. This is weird. I saw my wife reading it just now. My son received a notice from the, what do they call it, the Service Selection Committee from the United States. You know, to register for the draft.
Uh-huh.
Well, this is the second letter he's gotten. He hasn't registered yet. This one got a little nastier.
Whoa.
And did you know there's a $250,000 possible fine that goes along with that?
You mean if they don't respond to the draft? Or
yes. If they don't respond.
I didn't know that the draft was still in effect in the United States.
Well,
I thought,
you know, it used to be called registering for the draft. I don't think it's called that anymore, but it's a selective service committee that you have to register for, and basically they'll use that list as a draft selection service if a draft comes up again. I mean, we're since Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's
wow.
been voluntary.
Hmm.
Isn't that incredible?
Wow.
You know,
yeah, it is.
You know, I'm still reeling over this interview. That was an amazing interview. Richard Norton was a kind-hearted, no ego, no crap kind of guy that was just a true gentleman. I mean,
yes.
how many people can say that they taught Mick Jagger a reverse punch, or that they had Chuck Norris as the best man at his wedding?
Right, worked out or taught the ladies of ABBA. I mean, you know, just a wonderful, wonderful, down-to-earth gentleman, you know, has been there and done that and is still doing that. I mean,
right.
you know.
I think he's about 63 right now.
Yeah, yeah. And he's still doing it, and he's still rolling. He's still rolling doing jiu-jitsu, fight choreography, acting, the whole nine yards. And, you know, I only wish that, you know, when I get in my 60s that I can do the same thing, you know. And
you know, what's surprising, I have seen him on some of Jackie Chan's movies, but it didn't click who he was because it was done in Hong Kong. I did not
right.
know he was a Hong Kong film star. I remember, because he's always had that really, really thin mustache.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I remember him fighting Jackie on a boat. That was an amazing fight scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I forgot if it was a Jackie Chan movie, or I do know it was a Hong Kong movie. It might have been a Jackie Chan or a Yin Biu or... Who's that other guy? Is it Andy Lau that he was trying to talk? I think it was Andy Lau that he was trying to mention. But I don't remember what movie it was. And all of the fights that he was in, bad guy or not, were great. And, yeah, that whole Hong Kong era with both Cynthia and Richard and even the series where Cynthia and Richard were working together. Was that the China O'Brien series? I think that was the China O'Brien series.
Okay.
I think, because I know there was more than one China O'Brien, and then there was like Lady Dragon, but I don't think he was in that one. But yeah, those two movies were great. Also, as far as the fight scenes and stuff like that.
Well,
so,
and you notice it's so different from like Jackie's movies, like Hong Kong movies. They're so intricate and fast. And I mean, I was sitting next to a. I ran into somebody at the Honor Awards, and I knew she was a stunt woman. And
mm-hmm.
They showed one of, not it wasn't Jackie's scene, it wasn't somebody like that, but it was a Hong Kong fight scene. And
mm-hmm.
I looked over and said, "Have you ever blocked out a scene like that?" And she says, "Oh, yeah." I almost wanted to call him out on it.
Mm.
Because you just don't do those kind of scenes over here. I'm sorry, that's just not done.
I admire
those scenes. I admire the people that can do those scenes.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I was trying to think of the other movie that I saw with him in it. Was it Rage and Honor? I don't remember. There was. I know I'd seen both China O'Briens, Lady Dragon, American Ninja, but I don't know. I don't remember if he choreographed for that or if he was in it.
Now, was American Ninja a Hong Kong film, or was it done over here?
I think it was done over here.
Okay.
I think. I got, like, really confused back in the day, you know, when all the ninja movies came out, because there was, like, Revenge of the Ninja, Return of the Ninja, American Ninja, you know, and then there was that other one with that Olympic star. That wasn't Ninja. That was Gymkhana. That's right.
That's right. And then there was
that's
the,
right.
The, three ninjas, which one of the three ninjas actually teaches about a mile from my house.
Oh.
Now he teaches in Jeet Kune Do and some Kali. And then there was the one Surf Ninja. Now, it was funny about Surf Ninjas. That was with Ernie Reyes Jr.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Ernie Reyes Jr. had just, now, you know, my wife works in a pet store.
Mm-hmm.
Ernie Reyes Jr. had just bought a dog from her, right?
Uh-huh.
3 days later, or a week later, he had to return it because he was going to shoot that movie.
Oh, wow. You know, Jen meets, like, the coolest people. I mean, you know, you guys are like right in the heart of Burbank, you know, and that's a pretty big pet store too. You know, having gone in there, I'm like, because most pet stores that I go to, they're like really tiny, you know, and I'm talking just pet stores, not like Petco, you know, or PetSmart,
right,
which
right.
are like, you know,
family owned, that kind of thing. Sure.
Yeah. For a family owned pet store that isn't like the big box kind or whatever, right, that are about as big as like a Walmart or a Target. That's the biggest store I've been in, man. You know,
well,
I'm like, one of these days, I just need to go in and look around.
Well, her customers over the years have been Anita Pointer from the Pointer Sisters, Dwight Yoakam, Brian Austin Green and his wife that fazed me for a second, Billy Ray Cyrus, because we're right in the heart, we're right next to the big part of town, the Toluca Lake, which is where a lot of the stars live. That you know, I showed you Steve Carell's house and Bob Hope's house, Andy Griffith used to live there. And they got some of the big names going in that place.
Mm-hmm.
I met Brian Austin Green when he was on a break, where he was all balded out and all tatted up, and when he was doing his music more than his acting.
Oh, very cool. Oh, and you know, I just went over to the chat board. Deb, our usual listener, she writes, "Hey, Sifu Bob, she's taller than 4 feet. You have to be 4 feet or less to be a little person. So thank you, Deb."
Oh.
Thanks for getting my back, Deb. Yeah. But I saw Deb yesterday after I don't know how many years. Well, I take that back. I saw Deb this past year for World Tai Chi Day. Or was that last year? I forget. But as far as seeing Deb in the martial art setting, it's been like close to like 15 something years, and the turn of
we talked to her.
Yeah, I haven't seen her in like the martial art realm in that long, because I haven't been to this particular tournament in forever. This was the Botokakana Open, and for any Pacific Northwest people that are listening, I want to plug this tournament, because now I'm wondering why I stopped going. I think it was just because I was, like, too lazy to get on a ferry, or I was always doing something else, like going to another seminar or something. But it's been about, like, since 1992, I think, since I went to the Botokakon Open. So it's been a long time.
And you realize it's 21 years.
Yeah, okay, so it's 20 years, 21 years. I said, yeah, so okay, around 20, I said around. So it's been a long time. Since I've actually been to that tournament. And, you know, the tournament is great because, you know, for anyone that wants to get into competition and it's your first time, if you're a beginner or whatever, this is the perfect tournament to do it at, because, you know, the judges are fair. The venue is small enough to where it's not going to be overwhelming, you know, like arena, you know, like I'm used to like arena for like internationals and stuff like that, and that can be overwhelming if that's your first tournament. The judging is like I said, the judging is very fair, and you know, there's a fair amount of representation of different arts. There was several styles of karate there, not just my base style of Botokakon. Several styles of karate, taekwondo, kung fu, although, you know, I will say there was there could have been more representation of kung fu, hint hint to my own students who chickened out, because it's an open tournament, and I want to plug this tournament because number one, because the style Botokakon that sanctioned this yearly tournament that's been around for like 36 something years. And Deb, can you correct me on that, since you're on the board? Is it 35 or 36 years? I forget. It's been around for almost 40. That's all I know. The base of Botokakon was my base, and you know, Richard Norton was talking earlier about, you know, make sure you have a base, and I, you know, had this base was my base for 20 going on like 23, 25 years before I had gotten into Kajukenbo and the other arts and stuff like that. And it's still a part of me. And I really want to plug this tournament because, you know, there wasn't all that much representation yesterday. The tournament got done at 3 p.m., believe it or not. Started at 10, got done, and we were out by, well, we were out by 3:30. Locked the doors. And I was one of the last people to leave the parking lot, and it was not even 3:30. So, you know, yes, there were a fair amount of competitors to where it was still a competition. No one competed by themselves. But, you know, I'd like to see this tournament go back to, you know, when it was in its heyday. There were a lot of people competing at this tournament in the 70s and the 80s and stuff, a lot of people. And I'd really love for the Botokukan Open to get back into the mainstream of yearly tournaments, which is why I'm really plugging this tournament on our show today, because it was great. I saw a lot of people. I thought there were going to be people that – I thought everyone was going to forget about me because it's been 21 years. And, you know, people would come up to me, and I'd almost not recognize them because it's been that long, you know, gray hair and everything, right, you know? And they're like, oh, my God, where have you been? You know, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. And they didn't care that I was representing Kung Fu. They were just glad to see me. And, you know, and I'm actually thinking about trying to figure out a way to become active in Botokukan again, even though I can't really teach it because I can't. There's not enough time. So I think I'm going to get a hold of Soke Robert Hill and seeing about what I would need to do to at least become active in that community again, because I miss it. I miss the karate. I was judging karate forms, and I thought to myself, oh, my God, I miss this. I miss this kind of kata.
I want to know, you know, you represent Kung Fu, and you started in Bukokukan. What uniform mm-hmm. were you wearing yesterday to officiate it?
I was wearing a Jingmo. I was wearing the traditional – I was wearing a black – frog button top with red piping. So black with red piping, black kung fu pants, and wushu shoes. And same with the students that showed up. They were both wearing traditional, well, I shouldn't say traditional because they were half-sleeved ones, not the, you know, full-sleeved ones. But the sport, the kind of like the what they would call in kind of like the sport kung fu sparring. So like, you know, when you do tournament kung fu sparring, you would wear the half top, that kind of thing. And so we were wearing those, and we were the only people wearing those in a sea of white and black gis. And now I love wearing the karate gi. You know, my students see me in a karate gi every day because I like the kempo look, that kind of thing. And I love how the karate gis fit and how they pop and stuff like that. When it comes to just demonstrations, though, I'll wear the silk or I'll wear the kung fu uniforms or just a T-shirt and a sash. But yesterday when I was judging, I thought to myself, wow, I really freaking miss this. I miss karate. Even though I practice my katas on my own, but it's not the same to just do it on your own. You know, I kind of want to be around the same kind of people. So yeah, I'm thinking of trying to return just as a active black belt, but non-teaching. I just want to be part of that fold again because I, you know, seeing all those people brought back a lot of memories and stuff like that. I don't miss falling on my head, though. Saw some people, like, fall down, hit their head. So it was I don't know if I'm going to get back into the sparring thing, you know, because I don't want to pop an Achilles tendon or anything, but the kata, you know, I definitely want to see about, you know, maybe competing in kata again, so... It'll be cool. And
that would be cool.
Yeah, yeah. And Deb says it's 46 years that this tournament has been around. Not 36. It's been 46 years. So this tournament's been around forever. You hear that, Pacific Northwest people? Botokukan Open every year at around this time. Check it out. Represent your school and come check it out. It's a great tournament. So, yay. There was also blue geese. I forgot about the blue geese. Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know, our show's just about to wind down. And
yes,
we
it is.
Do have to talk about next week.
Yes.
What are we doing next week? Next week, I'm officiating the show. Not because you're going to be gone. Not because you're going to be at a seminar or at a tournament this time. This time, the show is going to be all about you, all about your Western Washington nomination, your nominations into the Women's Martial Arts Instructor Association in February. What else are we going to talk about? There's a whole laundry list of things we're going to talk about next week.
Yeah, there. Well, you know, I think the last time I did an interview where I was actually talking about stuff, right? About me, I guess, which, God, I hate talking about me, but when it comes to an interview, okay, I'll do it, was last year, I think, on Grandmaster Daryl Sargent's Modern Combat Masters show. And then the only other time before that I had done an interview was approximately 4 years prior to that on Martial Secrets with Sensei Chris Wilder. There was one more. I did a actual commercial radio show with Datu Kelly Warden on his show called On the Edge. And that actually went on commercial radio. So I haven't done very many interviews, and sure, why not? I'll do it.
let's talk about how was it that you actually ended up on Grandmaster Daryl's show?
Grandmaster Daryl, well, you mean how did I end up being part of the show?
How did you end up being a guest?
You know, I'm trying to get my timeline together. I don't remember if it was because we couldn't get a guest on that day or I couldn't, like, connect with that
you
guest. I don't
connect.
Think it was you. Yeah, I don't think it was you because we actually got you on Grandmaster Daryl's show, and that was no problem.
You could not connect with a guest, and Daryl finally said, we're going to interview you.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I don't remember who the guest was. All I remember was freaking out because I could not connect with this guest. I was like, and then the show started, and I'm like, well, Grandmaster Daryl, what are we going to talk about? But I guess this time, now that everyone knows it's actually going to be scheduled, I actually wrote it on my calendar that I'm going to be the one interviewed, which is going to be funny because I'm going to start the board and everything like a normal show. But I get to answer the questions, which will be fun because, you know, for those of you out there that listen to anyone doing a blog talk radio show, it's kind of tough to get a show together because you have to line up the guests, right? And it helps to have a co-host. And, you know, Sifu Bob, I don't tell you this enough. You know, I could not find a better co-host ever because this man works his tail off to make sure that shows go off without a hitch. He helps me contact guests. He helps keep the continuity of a show when we're live. He keeps the continuity of communication between ourselves and the guests. You know, he helps me market the show. I could not ask for a better co-host because, you know, I mean, I've got Grandmaster Daryl's show to market. I've got, you know, I got a ready for that, and on top of a full-time teaching schedule, I couldn't do it without you, bro. And I appreciate you from the bottom of my heart.
We've been very, very fortunate on our guests. We've been able to get guests weeks in advance. And I know sometimes your other show, it's the day before. We've just very fortunate. And the guests we've gotten have been phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like
and
today.
We've been blessed with great guests and wonderful listeners like Dev, who's still online, who is always online whenever she can. Thank you, Dev, for being such a loyal listener. Pass the link on to the Patokacon fold there, girl, because you know what? I'd love to get some of our Patokacon brothers and sisters on this show as well. We've already had Sensei Tyrone Asfi on here. We've had Soke Robert Hill on here as part of our Masters Hall of Fame series that we had some months back. And now I'd like to eventually get back to my roots also and interview some of the big names over there.
So, Deb, pass the word on. And I'll be passing the word on, too. I'll get on Facebook and see if we can get some of the Batokakon fold on our show. And, you know, let the world know a little bit more about Batokakon. Because I think it's time. You know, this art is too good to not be, you know, a little bit better known. That's
now,
just me being quiet.
Is Batokakon strictly Pacific Northwest art, or...
No, we've got there are dojos all over the place. There's a dojo in I knew that there was a dojo, I think, in Germany. I'm not going to be, don't quote me on it, but I know that there's a dojo out, I could swear, Africa somewhere, or Jamaica, I forget, one of those countries overseas, because I've seen videos of a sensei overseas teaching his students. And it's worldwide, but not every country has Batokakon. And it's relatively small in relation to other karate styles like Kyokushinkai, Goju-Ryu, Shito-Ryu, Shotokan, you know, stuff like that. It's not as well known. And it's not that I don't want Batokakon to be like, you know, huge, huge, huge with thousands of black belts. I just feel that it's important that the world knows more about this art that is a mixed art on its own. It's not, you know, I mean, it's traditional, yes, and it's karate, yes, but, you know, when Yoichi Nakachi came to the States, you know, and as it evolved, it became almost a mixed martial art in its own right, but kept the traditional katas and the traditional mindset of karate. So, you know, we do use, you know, elements of Wing Chun and judo and jujitsu before MMA became really popular, and that was really attractive to me when I was a kid, you know, and I stayed with that base for like 21, 23 years, and decided, okay, you know, I'm going to explore other things, and now 20-something years later, you know, I think it's time to go back to my roots, but we can talk more about that next week. But I do want Deb to pass on the message that I would like some of the Batokakon senseis here in the Pacific Northwest to join us for a forum show, and I'd love for them to get their take on Batokakon. You got that, Deb? Pass the message on. Ha ha. All right.
that would be great. We have Silky Hill on again and Tyrone on again and a bunch of the other senseis on. That would be a great show.
Yeah, I think it would be really cool. All right. Well, wow, we had a great show, although we did it backwards with the interview first. So
and I was really impressed because, you know, when you and I were talking up front that we were going to have a delay because we had to use Skype since Master Richard was in Australia, and there was no delay at all.
No delay at all, and I think it was because he had a really fast computer, and that I... this morning also when I was figuring out the whole Skype thing, I completely like cleaned out the computer, you know, cleared the cache, cleared the partitions and everything and stuff like that, and it was as close to, you know, talking on the phone like it would be with me and you, and I was really happy about that. So this whole day turned out really good. You know, we managed to figure out how to connect overseas with Skype without a hitch. It was a great interview with Master Richard. Thank you again, Master Richard. If anyone missed it, you didn't call in, too bad, so sad. Listen to the archive show. All right. So tune in next week, everyone, where our special guest is, well, me. Sifu Bob is going to take the helm for next week's show, and I get to sit back and relax and just answer questions. No, I take that back. I'll keep an eye on the board, too, like I normally do.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, have a great weekend, Sifu Bob. Have a great rest of the weekend, listeners. And we'll see you all next week. Have a great rest of the week. Bye-bye now.